And the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War for stepping up and making sure that this event could continue. It's been kind of interesting to me. I've been to a lot of controversial meetings, but I was usually the one in the audience opposing the speaker. This last week, I was in the Richmond City Jail as a guest speaker to two groups of inmates, one of them who are working for their high school equivalency certificate, and the other a member of a group called Belief Program, which is a self-help program for inmates. And in order to do this, you have to be, in order to become a speaker in the city jail, you have to be vetted and approved by the sheriff. So the sheriff of Richmond, Virginia, in the south of the United States, does not consider me to be a controversial speaker, but apparently I'm notorious in Hamilton, Ontario. So I hope that at least would raise a question in somebody's minds that maybe some of the things that have been said about what I'm supposed to be speaking about tonight may in fact not be true. The reason I'm here is because I'm very worried that the United States is going to attack Iran or allow Israel to attack. I think it's a very serious situation, and it's one that has ebbed and flowed over the past number of years. In 2006, there was a U.S. aircraft carrier called the Eisenhower, ironically named after the president who headed the United States when the CIA carried out its first foreign coup to overthrow a democratically elected leader, and that, of course, was Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh of Iran. And the USS Eisenhower was being sent to the Persian Gulf. And there was speculation in Time magazine and The Nation magazine that there was going to be, that might be a preparation for a military attack. And so there was a little demonstration in Norfolk, Virginia. That's the most highly concentration of military bases in the world, where the ship was leaving from. And some friends of mine organized it, and some of the people who came were Iranian-Americans from Washington, D.C., associated with the group Campaign Against Sanctions and Military Intervention in Iran, CASME, and that's how we first met Rostam Versal and some others. And Rostam, who used to be a tour guide in Iran before he moved to this country in the 60s, was very concerned that Americans were getting a very distorted view of Iran as a place that was evil and foreboding and dangerous, and God forbid you should ever wake up one morning and find yourself in Iran and people recognize that you were from the United States. God, that would be the end of it, wouldn't it? And he suggested that some of us just go and visit Iran for ourselves. And it was seemed like a good time, and I was just finishing up my midlife crisis, and I thought it would be a nice journey. And we put together I go through it about every 5 years, since my 20s. And we got five people together, two U.S. Army veterans, a woman who's an environmentalist, and an old friend of mine who was a labor activist, and we went and we toured the country basically as tourists. We contracted with a local tourist agency, and we went on a 1,350-mile van ride through Tehran, Shiraz, Yazd, Isfahan, Homs, and had an amazing number of wonderful experiences. Nothing negative whatsoever. We were just completely overwhelmed with the friendliness of the people who didn't know who we were until we had a chance to, you know, stop and talk, didn't know why we were there, including a chance encounter with 300 members of the Revolutionary Guard who were on a tour guide through Yazd, and we ran into, and just, there we were, face to face, five Americans and 300 Revolutionary Guard members. And one of them said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Canada." And then Tom yelled out, "USA!" And they all started waving and giving the peace sign and saying, "Welcome, friends, peace." I mean, this happened. I read about it in the book. There was no animosity whatsoever towards us as Americans from the United States. And we came back, and Rostam Frizal and myself and a woman named Samin Rayanian, who's also Iranian-American, did a tour of about 15 cities, and I talked about my experiences, just what I saw in Iran, which was so different than was the impression that most Americans have. And Rostam and Samin answer the more political questions. What about the nuclear non-proliferation treaty? What about the IAEA? What about this, that, and the other? And so I got a chance to listen to them 15 times, and did a lot of my own research and looking into the various questions and listening to the questions that people asked us. Well, didn't President Ahmadinejad call for Israel to be wiped off the face of the map? Didn't he deny the Holocaust? What's the situation of women in Iraq? What's the situation of gays and lesbians? And in looking, in researching these answers, we realized that the best thing we could do is put it all together in one place, and that's the book. So the trip is the hook. I told my mother I was going to write a book. And she said, what about? I said, how about Iran? You know, about how the U.S. claims that Iran is trying to develop a nuclear weapon and is a threat to world peace and wants to destroy Israel. And my mother says, no one's going to read that. I said, what do you mean? She says, you went to Iran. That's what you know. Write about that. So that's what the book is, with all the research. So what my purpose in coming here was to try to talk about some of the media myths which basically come from the U.S. government and its allies in trying to demonize Iran. And I want to run through some of those and then try to explain why I think Iran is being demonized, and then finish up with a little statement that Kazmi has just produced to try to help raise the issue of Iran more in the upcoming demonstrations. And for the record, I don't get paid to do this. One of the there were a lot of insults written about me in terms of this talk tonight, about how I take money from the Revolutionary Guards. I'm an apologist for President Ahmadinejad. The worst one was that I was a Harvard professor. I was proudly thrown out of college for my academic career, for my activism, or my recklessness as a youth. But I do this because I believe in it, and I hope that's why people do their political work. There's a little statement here, and a couple of things to read from the media. But one of the things I like about the book is it's got 180 footnotes and there's no Wikipedia. Everything is mainstream sources, the World Bank, the United Nations, UNESCO, Los Angeles Times, Reuters. People may disagree with the political conclusions of the book, but I challenge them to find anything wrong with any of the facts that are presented. But here's a fact. In 2008, June 5th, the then chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Jay Rockefeller, made some remarkable comments announcing the finding of a bipartisan report of a multi-year study on misstatements on pre-war intelligence on Iraq. Rockefeller said, quote, in making the case for war, the administration repeatedly presented intelligence as fact when in reality it was unsubstantiated, contradicted, or even non-existent. As a result, the American people were led to believe that the threat from Iraq was much greater than actually existed. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There was no connection with Al-Qaeda. There was no connection with 9/11. And those were the three reasons that the Bush administration put forward to justify what would become the death of more than 4,000 U.S. GIs, 1,000 civilian contractors, and no one knows how many Iraqis because the U.S. military doesn't count enough with people it kills. Today we're being told that Iran is a dangerous country that's developing nuclear weapons and wants to destroy Israel and must be stopped, even if it means a military attack. And I'm not the only person who thinks it sounds very much like the lies that we were told before the Iraq war. Now, here's a more recent news story from the Herald Scotland, a newspaper from Scotland, published on March 14th. Hundreds of powerful U.S. bunker buster bombs are being shipped from California to the British island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean in preparation for a possible attack on Iran. The Sunday Herald can reveal that the U.S. government signed a contract in January to transport 10 ammunition containers to the island. According to a cargo manifest from the U.S. Navy, this includes 387 blue bombs used for blasting hardened or underground structures. And then further down, it says, oh, I missed that quote. Well, it goes on to say that there was intimations of this before, but now it's been confirmed because it's posted on an international website by the U.S. Navy. Bunker-busting bombs. That's to get at the underground facilities that the U.S. says Iran is using to develop nuclear weapons. So that's, and this is not being publicized generally. This was not something that came out in order to scare Iran and to keep it in line. This was something they did sort of under the radar, which makes it more ominous. U.S. beefs up defenses near Iran. Los Angeles Times, January 31st. The Obama administration has increased the U.S. military presence near Iran and is accelerating the installation of anti-missile systems in nearby countries, officials said Saturday, as the White House builds pressure for stern new sanctions against Iran. New air defense systems are being delivered to Persian Gulf countries, and specially equipped cruisers, a linchpin of the U.S. missile defense system, are being deployed in the waters of the Persian Gulf. That's the Aegis cruise missiles that they're now putting in the Persian Gulf. One of those ships was the type that shot down the Iranian Airbus in 1988, killing almost 300 civilian men, women, and children. In an incident that the U.S. called a mistake, it was under Ronald Reagan, and then gave medals to the captain of the ship and the top officers. Never apologized and never made restitution. Here's a quote from John Bolton. He used to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and he's a member in good standing of the neoconservative, neocon club of political observers, pundits, agents, operatives in the United States. He says, those who oppose Iran acquiring nuclear weapons are left in the near term with only the option of targeted military force against its weapons facilities. Okay, so things are looking a little serious. There was just kind of a surge in threats against Iran that came up just before we made our trip to Iran, and then again in 2008 when we decided to write the book, put all that information together in one place. So the basic charges against Iran that are promulgated by the United States government and picked up and repeated endlessly by the mass media are that, number one, Iran is a country that is run by a bunch of really crazy people who cannot be trusted to act as other countries' leaderships act, that they're fanatical, they're maniacal, they're diabolical, they don't care if they live or die, and they can't be trusted with any type of military threat in the area. Number two, that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, or developing the capacity to produce nuclear weapons. That Iran has a program to develop nuclear power that they want to use to power nuclear plants to produce energy. But the United States charges that, in effect, that's just a cover for developing nuclear weapons. Further, that the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, has threatened to destroy Israel, has denied the Holocaust, has threatened neighbors, supports terrorism, and that Iran is not responsive to dialogue, discussion, or sanctions, and therefore the window of opportunity of stopping a possible World War III is narrowing, and Iran must be stopped. Okay, I think that's about it. There is no proof at all by anyone in the world that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. Zero. Not from the United States Intelligence Services, which in 2007 issued a report, a national intelligence estimate, which stated that their best guess was that Iran was not developing nuclear weapons. They said they didn't know if Iran wanted to. Well, I don't know if they want to either. I don't know what a lot of people are planning on doing. But they said there is no reason to think they're developing nuclear weapons. And the next day, George Bush gave a press conference in which a reporter asked him about that, and he said, I believe Iran was a threat yesterday, and I believe Iran is a threat today. And the reporter said, Mr. President, don't you feel a little funny standing up there telling people, you know, that Iran is a threat when your national intelligence agencies say that they're not? Doesn't that bother you? And Bush said, no, I feel pretty good. No, I feel pretty good today. It didn't matter. It didn't matter what they said. And the national intelligence community, which, if you want to call it that, which in the United States, which is made up of 16 separate intelligence agencies. I didn't know we had 16 until this recording. But they haven't repudiated that estimate. Till today. There is no proof. Now, Iran does have a program to develop nuclear power. That's right. It's situated in primarily in the Taz, which I happened to drive past as we were going through Iran. We didn't think, you know, we specifically said we didn't want to go anywhere near Iran, the Taz, because we didn't want to raise any questions on anybody's mind about what we were doing there. And it turned out we just drove down the highway past the Natanz facility. Most of it's underground, but this building's there, and you can see a few anti-aircraft positions around. But, you know, not much. It's more, you know, just deserted than anything else. But as I said, most of it's supposed to be on the ground. It does have this program. Now, is that something bad? Well, no. First of all, I should say I don't support nuclear power, period. And the reason is because there's no safe way to dispose of the fuel. What they call the spent, you know, you put the fuel in these rods, and then when they finish their life usefulness, they're still radioactive, and you have to get rid of them somewhere. And these spent fuel rods are going to be radioactive for the next 100 years, and there's no safe place to put them. So I don't support nuclear power. However, if France can get 80% of its present energy needs met by nuclear power plants, and the world can get 13% of its energy needs met by nuclear power plants, and the United States can use nuclear power plants, and if President Obama can just come out and say he's authorizing the opening of the first nuclear power plant in 30 years since the disaster of Three Mile Island, how can you tell another country they can't have a nuclear power plant? How can we do that? Who left the, you know, what made you go? Thank you. In the 60s, the United Nations came up with a treaty to try to discourage nuclear weapon proliferation. And eventually, most of the countries in the world signed it. It's called the Non-Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, shortened to the NPT. And according to this treaty, which Iran signed in the 60s under the Shah, it was one of the first countries to sign the treaty. According to this treaty, if you do not have nuclear weapons and you promise not to develop them, you will be recognized as having the right to develop nuclear power for peaceful energy purposes. Not only will you have the right, but you will receive assistance from the countries that have nuclear power. Get that? According to this treaty, not only does Iran have the right under international law to have nuclear power plants and to enrich uranium to the point of 4 or 5% that's necessary to run those plants, but it can expect to get help in developing them. And what is the United States and its allies telling Iran? You have to stop enriching uranium. Meanwhile, the NPT also says that those countries that have nuclear weapons already have to make an effort to reduce their stockpiles and eventually do away with them altogether. Is that happening? Is there any country in the world that's reducing its nuclear stockpiles? So it's not Iran that's in violation of the NPT. It's the United States. And yet, it's the United States that is accusing Iran of violating international law and imposed sanctions right after the Iranian Revolution of its own, and then has used its powerful leverage to force the United Nations Security Council to impose 3 separate sets of sanctions against Iran for supposedly violating the NPT. Now, there's a watchdog agency that the UN set up, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, which inspects countries that are signatories to the NPT. And Iran is the most inspected country in the entire world. not only according to the regular standards that countries are supposed to agree to, but it signed what's called additional protocols, which means that it allows more intrusive inspections. And there's no evidence that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon. Just a little technical thing here, because this comes up every once in a while, and they never really explain it. Uranium is a natural element found in the earth, and in order to make it useful for producing energy or nuclear weapons, you have to enrich it. It's a technical process that involves taking uranium-235 out of the element 238 through a process of hundreds or thousands of what they call centrifuges that spin the element at a terrific speed and in synchronization with each other. It's a very difficult process to pull off, and Iran's been able to get it to the point of 4 to 5% where it can develop, can use that energy that enriched uranium for nuclear power. There's been a recent controversy come up because Iran has one nuclear reactor that was actually built under the Shah, under pressure by the United States, that wanted the Shah to develop nuclear power because Westinghouse and General Electric stood to make $6 billion in contracts. And that process started, and the first nuclear reactor was one in Tehran. And it's called the Tehran Research Reactor, or TRR for short. And it's used to make radioisotopes. I don't know what that is, but that's the right word. To help cancer patients. It's used in medical research and treatment. And in order to make that reactor function, you need uranium enriched to a degree of 20%. And so Iran has just announced that it's capable of doing that. In order to make a enriched uranium that's powerful enough to trigger a nuclear bomb, or to be the ammunition of a nuclear bomb, you have to enrich uranium to about 95%, which is a much more difficult process. And it involves many more centrifuges, and they have to be reconfigured, set up in a different way. And you can't do that, you know, like after 5 o'clock when the doors are closed. It's a huge operation, and there's no way they can pull it off without not only IAEA, but the CIA and the Mossad and every other Western intelligence agency knowing about it. So that's the argument on a technical level that Iran is not trying to develop nuclear weapons. On a political level, President Ahmadinejad says they don't want nuclear weapons because they're not useful anymore. This time has passed. You start a nuclear war, everyone dies. So, which is not an irrational thing to say. Although President Ahmadinejad doesn't have anything to say about nuclear weapons because he's not head of the military. The Iranian president is not the commander-in-chief, as it is in the United States. The commander-in-chief is the supreme leader, who is Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who has issued a fatwa, a religious edict, with the force of law, saying that it would be against Islam to develop nuclear weapons. Why? Because it's a weapon of mass destruction and it kills the innocent. And if you fight a war, you cannot kill the innocent. Now, people might say, well, you know, so what? They said something, of course they're going to say it. That's just propaganda. But during the 8-year war with Iraq, when Saddam Hussein was using chemical weapons against civilians, as well as the military of Iran, and when it was bombing cities, civilian populations, using nerve gas, the Iranian military went to the Ayatollah Khomeini, the first supreme leader, and asked him to be able to retaliate in kind, and he said no, because those would be weapons of mass destruction. And they didn't do it, and there's no evidence that they did it. See? So, you know, from a technical point of view, from a political point of view, from a religious point of view, there's good arguments against the accusation that Iran is trying to develop nuclear weapons. And yet, not a week goes by in the United States that you don't see an article by the Associated Press referring to Iran's nuclear ambitions. And that's an interesting way to phrase it, because what does that mean? That can mean nuclear power plants, or it can mean nuclear weapons. You see? They just throw it out there. Obama's inability to stop Iran's nuclear weapons. The West's inability to accept Iran's nuclear, Ahmadinejad's refusal to disavow Iran's nuclear ambitions. And so the average person thinks, gee, Iran's going to bomb us, you know, if they get the bomb. We can't allow that. How belligerent is Iran? Iran is a country that has not invaded a neighbor or attacked another country in more than 200 years. Unless you count a couple of incursions under the Shah that were done at the behest of the U.S. But certainly in the last 30 years, Iran has not attacked another country. It was attacked by Iraq, and there's not a family in Iran today that wasn't affected in some way by that war. And this is a country that doesn't want war. I don't care where they stand on the political perspective, on the political spectrum. Iranians don't want another war. Did Ahmadinejad call for the destruction of Israel? The quote was that Ahmadinejad said that Israel should be wiped off the map. I take it there's a number of Farsi speakers here. My understanding is there is no such phrase in Farsi, so it would have to be a translation anyway.
What phrase?
Wipe off the map.
Yeah,
it is. Oh, really?
It was mentioned on TV at the time, where it was actually.
But that's a Farsi expression.
Yeah, the expression was out.
Okay, I stand corrected. I'll stop saying that. However, that's not what he said. It was a mistranslation. And the original is available, to find it on the internet. And what he said was, as the Imam said, referring to Ayatollah Khomeini, this regime, referring to Israel, must disappear from the pages of history. And when he was asked about that on Democracy Now! By Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez last year when they did an interview with him, and it was videoed, you can see it on the internet, he said, well, he didn't mean a physical destruction, he meant like the collapse of the Soviet Union, that it would fall apart as a result of his own contradictions. He wasn't calling for the destruction of Israel, which makes sense because Iran is not an anti-Semitic country. Iran, in fact, has the largest Jewish population in the Middle East or South Asia of any country in the region except for Israel. Some 30,000 people, and they've been there for 3,000 years. There are 11 functioning synagogues in Tehran. There are kosher shops. There's a Jewish library. There's a Jewish hospital. There's a guaranteed participation in the masjid, the parliament, by the Jewish community, as there is for the Christians and the Zoroastrians, not for the Baha'is. Baha'is don't enjoy religious freedom in Iran. And there's particular reasons for that I don't agree with, don't justify, but it's not just that they don't have, not like Baha'is. But the Jewish community is a respected and long-established part of Iranian society. Did Ahmadinejad deny the Holocaust? That was a little harder. I spent about an afternoon researching a lot of different quotes. And most of them were something like, by Ahmadinejad, something like, if the Holocaust happened, then, and people would say, see, he's questioning the Holocaust. He said, if. And, of course, the first time he said that, and there was such a reaction in the West, he wasn't necessarily depressed over that. He's a politician. And he got support in the Arab world. And, of course, Iran is not primarily Arab. Primarily Persian, multinational, but primarily Persian. And, he was seen as ticking off the United States. Was it a good thing? It's probably been the most problematical thing about the entire situation between the U.S. and Iran that the question of the Holocaust has been denied. Because in the West, the Holocaust is the disaster in human history. And I'm particularly sensitive to this because I believe my father's side of the family was Jewish and that we lost people in the Holocaust. I don't know because he was over here and his father was over here and the village that his grandfather grew up was destroyed. It no longer exists, which is why we think it was there. But the old family name is Lapin, not Willato. And that's because back in the 1880s, one of my great-great-great-grandfathers was murdered by a mob. And his wife married a guy named Willato, and we think what happened was he was killed in a Tsarist pogrom, and his wife remarried a Gentile to protect the children. I can't prove it, so I don't put it in writing, but I think that's what happened. And it makes me think, the Holocaust, it was one of the worst atrocities ever committed in the world. Of course, it wasn't 6 million Jews alone. It was 6 million Jews and 5 million communists, trade unionists, gays, Romas, gypsies, Eastern Europeans, people with mental disabilities, and so on. But of course, saying there were 11 million killed, 6 of them who were Jews, is not as good in a propaganda technique to develop support for Israel is if you just said 11 million people were killed and 6 million were Jews. It's better to reduce it just to 6 million Jews, which is something I never quite understood until I thought about it in relation to the Middle East. What Ahmadinejad is saying is, and this came out in an interview again with Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez, the Holocaust was a European phenomenon. European Gentiles killed European Jews in Europe. How does that justify European Jews coming to the Middle East and taking the land that was going to the Palestinians? How is that justified? And why do you keep asking me about it? I have nothing to do with it. This is what he says. So, does it show some insensitivity? Yeah, I think it does. But does it mean he's denying the Holocaust? No, if you read the interview with Amy Goodman. What he's saying is that if it happened like you said it happened, then you won't let us talk about it, you won't let us examine it, you won't let us look into the history of it, that's revolting. Then it's your problem, not ours. So, a lot of us wish he would just come right out and say, you know, the Holocaust happened, it was one of the worst things that had happened in the world, and it's, you know, and we had nothing to do with it, and we're sorry. Some of those Jews who were escaping the Holocaust wound up in Iran. Some of their descendants live there today. So, I'm trying to counter the arguments that Iran is dangerous to the world, that it's trying to develop a nuclear weapon, that the president denied the Holocaust, that the president called for the destruction of Israel. What about terrorism? Does Iran support terrorism? Well, as I explained in the book, I grew up in Massachusetts. My folks used to bring us around to all the historical sites from the Revolutionary War. And we'd go to Concord, where the shock heard around the world was. And actually, that was Lexington. I always get a little mixed up. They had the shock heard around the world. That's because Paul Revere said the British were coming, and he came at night, and everybody came out, all the Minutemen came out, and the British didn't come until the morning, so they spent the night in the pub drinking flips, which is rum and get a hot poker and butter. By the time the morning came, no one knew who fired the shot heard around the world. But then the British went to Concord, and as they had there, and as they marched back to Boston with their red coats in formation, the farmers, who were known as the Minutemen because they could get ready in a minute, they came out and shot at the British retreating from behind boulders and rocks and trees. And the British said, "That's not fair. You can't fight like that. You're supposed to stand out in the middle of the field so we can shoot you down." So they were called terrorists. So, I mean, I support the struggle of the Palestinian people for self-determination. Peaceful resolution to the problems between Israelis and Palestinians. But if the Israelis insist on carpet bombing Gaza, on arresting Palestinian children, on torture and murder and disappearances, I support the right of the Palestinian people to take up arms and to defend their community. If Iran supports Hamas, which, by the way, is Sunni, not Shia, and supports Hezbollah for similar reasons in Lebanon as a resistance force against Israeli aggression, I think they not only have the right to do that, they should be applauded for doing that. That is not supportive. Now, on the other hand, Al-Qaeda just issued a statement the other day calling for Iran to release the brother of the Osama bin Laden. They claim that they're holding some dozens of his family members. See, Iran says, "I don't know anything about them." Iran tried to get rid of the Taliban in Afghanistan before the U.S. did.
That's right.
And was congratulated by the U.S. for their help in helping to set up a post-Taliban government in Iran. Donated more money to that effort than an international conference held in Japan than any other country in the world. No ties with Al-Qaeda, no ties with the Taliban, targeted by those countries, actually, but by those movements, but yet is called a terrorist organization. And now there's only one official military in the world that has been characterized as a terrorist organization, and that's the Revolutionary Guards. Let's see, the only one. Iran is the biggest problem in the world right now, isn't it? Isn't that what we're told? It's the most dangerous, it's the biggest threat to the United States. You know, Is that really true? I thought it was hunger. I thought it was poverty. You know, when the earthquake happened in the Port-au-Prince in Haiti, President Obama sent down $100 million for relief and about $300 million to back the military efforts to move in case the Haitian government crumbled and the popular forces began to come to power. $100 million, how much is that? That's what it costs to run the Iraq war for 5 hours.
Wow.
That's 0.1% of the bonuses that Goldman Sachs gave its top executives last year.
Yeah.
$100 million. We have a war in this world. We have a war against ignorance, against poverty, against prejudice and discrimination and racism and sexism and homophobia. That's the war we ought to be fighting. The Western powers can't win a war against anger. They can kill somebody, but all they do is create 10 or 15 more angry people. There's no solution that way. No one in this room is safe. It's safer because of what the Western powers have done. I could go on for a lot longer, but we wanted to make sure that we left plenty of time for questions and answers. I want to end with just the statement that Kasmi put together. And actually, this was my initiative. And I say that because if I get wiped out in the car wreck on the way home tomorrow, I want somebody to know I did this. Because this statement is now being circulated around the world among anti-war organizations. It's on the website of International Answer that's sponsoring the March 20th demonstrations and the National Assembly in the Iraq and Afghanistan of wars and occupations. It's on many, many websites. It's even showing up on some oil industry websites on the commentary in the Middle East. I checked last night. But I want to read it and then go into the question and answers. And one of the reasons why I really feel good about it is that within CASB, there's a wide range of opinions about what's currently happening within Iraq. There are people who are very strong supporters of the Green Movement and opposing the government, and there are people who support the government and are not so sympathetic to the Green Movement. And yet, we were able to come together and unanimously endorse this statement, which I think shows some hope for progress not only in the anti-war movements, but also for the situation within Iran itself. It's called an appeal to anti-war organizations and activists to oppose the increasing threats against Iran. Around the world, anti-war activists are preparing for major protests this spring to oppose the continuing U.S.-led occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. Meanwhile, a storm of developments is dramatically increasing tensions between the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran. In response, the Campaign Against Sanctions and Military Intervention in Iran is issuing this appeal to the anti-war movements in the United States, United Kingdom, and other countries to raise the demands of no war, no sanctions, no internal interference in Iran. Iran is a country that hasn't attacked a neighbor in more than 200 years. Even when Saddam Hussein invaded Iran after the 1979 revolution, and with support from the West used chemical weapons against both civilians and combatants, the Islamic Republic did not retaliate in kind. And yet the U.S. government claims that Iran represents a serious threat to the Middle East region and the entire world. Without a shred of evidence, the U.S. charges that Iran's program to develop nuclear power for peaceful energy purposes is just a cover to develop nuclear weapons. Never mentioned is the fact that as a signatory to the U.N.'s Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran's right to develop nuclear energy is enshrined in international law. Just a few months ago, the UN's International Atomic Energy Chief, Mohammed Al-Baradei, the person responsible for monitoring compliance with that treaty, stated that, quote, nobody is sitting in Iran today developing nuclear weapons. Tehran doesn't have an ongoing nuclear weapons program. But somehow, everyone in the West is talking about how Iran's nuclear program is the greatest threat to the world, unquote. Instead, warning of world disaster if Iran should succeed in its imaginary goal of obtaining nuclear arms, Washington argues that Iran must be forcibly brought to its knees through a combination of increasingly crippling sanctions, taking advantage of Iran's internal divisions, and preparing for a possible military attack. Consider these recent developments. The U.S. has been pressuring the permanent members of the U.N. Security Council to impose a fourth and more severe round of sanctions against Iran. The only real holdout has been the People's Republic of China, which in January held the Council's revolving presidency. On February 1st, however, the president's seat passed to France, which is nearly as hostile to Iran's nuclear program as is the U.S. France itself, by the way, relies on nuclear power for 80% of its own energy needs. Security Council's permanent members, including China and Russia, have never been a real barrier for the U.S. Not only has the Council already approved three rounds of sanctions against Iran, but the Obama administration is now talking of, quote, bypassing the U.N. in its latest push for sanctions. While sanctions are often promoted as an alternative to war, the world now knows that the sanctions imposed by the U.N. against Iraq during the first Persian Gulf War resulted in the deaths of up to 1.5 million Iraqis, a third of them children. Not content with just pressuring the U.N., the U.S. is pushing ahead with plans for more of its own unilateral sanctions. Congress is getting close to passing the Dodd-Shelby Comprehensive Iran Sanctions Accountability and Divestment Act. Among other provisions, this bipartisan bill would, quote, impose new sanctions on entities involved in exporting certain refined petroleum products to Iran or building Iran's domestic refining capacity, unquote. This provision starkly exposes the real U.S. goal, to economically cripple Iran in an attempt to so complicate life for the Iranian people that they might demand a, quote, regime change. In the past, the U.S. has argued that Iran doesn't need to develop nuclear power because of its vast oil reserves, while conveniently omitting the fact that Iran doesn't have sufficient refinery capacity to meet its energy needs through oil alone. Targeting companies and countries that sell refined petroleum products to Iran or that help Iran develop its own refining capacity shows that the real goal has nothing to do with countering nuclear proliferation. The U.S. even pressures European countries not to provide Iran with the means to develop wind energy. Those who desire hegemony over the oil-rich Middle East can tolerate no independent powers, whether or not they present a threat to any other country. This reality was dramatically demonstrated in 1953 when the CIA toppled Iran's democratically elected prime minister, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, for the crime of nationalizing Iran's oil industry. Meanwhile, these threats of new sanctions are being accompanied by a military buildup in the Persian Gulf. I'll skip that part because we went over that in the beginning part of the talk. Finally, Iran's ongoing internal political crisis has apparently led some Western anti-war organizations and activists to be ambivalent about the need to stand against Western aggression against Iran. Regardless of how activists view Iran's internal situation, we must all agree that outside pressure and interference must be opposed. As presidential opposition candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi has put it, we are opposed to any types of sanctions against our nation. This is what living the green path means. Unquote. No truly progressive democracy activist in a country targeted by the U.S. would appeal to the U.S. for support. The political positions taken by anti-war activists in the West can become a real factor in strategic decisions made by the U.S. government and its allies. Because of this, we are heartened to see that in the United States, the National Assembly to End the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars and Occupations and the Answer Coalition have added the demand of no war or sanctions against Iran to their flyers, promoting national anti-war protests on March 20th. We call on all other coalitions, organizations, and individual activists to do the same, and to further demand no outside interference in Iran's internal affairs, self-determination for the Iranian people. Regardless of differences in our political analyses and views, these demands should be acceptable to all who struggle for peace, justice, and a better world for all. We have copies of that statement, and we're asking folks if they would endorse those three demands on behalf of your organization. No war, no sanctions, no internal interference in Iran.
Thanks very much, Bill. I have copies of the statement for everyone, and I can bring them to the back table. You can just pick up a copy if you like, if you're interested, and bring it back to any organizations that you might be working with. Well, I'd like to thank Bill very much. I appreciate everyone giving their thanks as they did. And I just wanted to say that coming up, we're having question period. There's some announcements I'd want to make a bit later on, and there's other events, and then we're going to get into that. But before we go to question period, I thought I should mention that there are costs associated with this event. We did have to bring Phil up. Phil did try for 11 hours. There's gas costs. We did have to publicize this with posters, make reservations, do room bookings. So we'd appreciate if people could pitch in a little to help us with our costs of the event, just to cover the cost of the event and make things easier for holding up.